Well, this looks very nice, Latimer. A grand country house. Now tell me, are there any ghosts?
No, ma'am.
Any evil scientists in the attic?
Not in the attic, ma'am.
Or anywhere else?
I can't promise that, ma'am, but I haven't seen any.
Well, this looks like exactly the restful location I need after the last few weeks. It will give me some time to think about that dreadful riddle.
I've been thinking about the riddle too, ma'am.
You have? Have you worked it out?
I believe we don't need to work it out, ma'am. Clearly, the man who composed it wants us to answer the riddle and find him there. Surely we do not want to do this. He sounds like a dreadful bore.
But won't he think he's smarter than me?
Yes, ma'am. But he'll be the one waiting for you. On his own. Forever.
Well, when you put it that way, Latimer, let's ignore it for now. What could possibly go wrong?
Tea and Jeopardy with Emma Newman. There's always time for a nice cup of tea and a spot of mild peril.
Well, hello there, my lovelies. I do hope you're well and haven't been struggling to cope with reality after a weekend away in a magical realm. I'm Emma Newman, and I'd like to welcome you into my secret tea lair for polite conversation, abject geekery, a cheeky bit of cake, and of course, a nice cup of tea. This house is all one could possibly want from a Grand Georgian pile in the country. Huge windows, perfectly proportioned rooms, and the overstuffed sofas that aren't nearly as comfortable as they appear. We've brought extra cushions, so please do make yourselves as comfy as possible and keep out of the drafts. They can be brutal in houses like this.
I'm sorry to disturb you, ma'am, but your guest has arrived, a Miss Maura McHugh.
Ah, splendid. Let's see her calling card.
I'm not sure it is a calling card, ma'am. It may be an artistic installation.
Heavens! How is it making that Mobius strip hover like that? Oh, it's moving, always moving. The different colours. Now it's an Ouroboros. So pretty. Must keep watching.
I think that's enough of that, ma'am. I'll take this and put it in the safe place where you can't get it. Along with the China Mieville, Tom Hiddleston and Eva Green pictures.
Oh, Latimer!
It's for your own good, ma'am. You can have them back when your guest has gone.
Well, show her in then, Latimer.
Very good, ma'am.
For those of you who don't know, Maura McHugh is a writer of plays, comics and short stories. Her comic book series, Jennifer Wilde, was nominated for an Eagle Award for Favourite European Comic Book in 2012 and for the British Fantasy Award for Best Comic Book / Graphic Novel in 2014.
Ms. Maura McHugh, ma'am.
Hello, Maura. Do come and sit down. How are you?
Well, I'm very good today, actually, and I'm much cheered up by these delightful surroundings.
Isn't it just lovely? I just needed some fresh air just to convalesce. It's a beautiful part of the world.
Yes, and it's spring.
Yes, thank goodness.
Oh, yes. My favourite time of the year. I was born in spring.
Oh, how lovely.
Yes.
Would you care for some tea?
Oh, yes.
And how do you take your tea?
Well, what type of tea is it? I should have asked.
Well, I'm going with English breakfast tea at the moment because I'm recuperating from illness, so I didn't want anything too fancy.
Oh, yes. Well, I'll actually take that black with a bit of lemon.
Oh, yes, we have some lemon just in case.
And no sugar.
No sugar.
No.
I will pour. And would you like some cheesecake to go with that?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I do like a little bit, a small bit.
Yes, it can be quite rich, can't it?
Yes, it can.
Now, don't mind the chickens over there. You're not allergic to chickens, are you?
Oh, no, I live in Ireland. It's not like we have them roaming in every home, but chickens are something one sees in the countryside. Yes, my grandparents used to keep chickens, in fact.
Oh, marvellous. So you'll feel very at home here then.
Well, yes, you know, they're not my best friends, but, you know, I do like chickens.
Marvellous. Now, in my invitation, I asked you to bring a curio with you. Mm-hmm. What have you decided to bring with you today?
Well, I'm bringing a little statue of Ganesha, the Hindu god, which sits beside my keyboard when I'm writing.
Oh, marvellous. He's so delightfully colourful.
Oh, yes. That's why I actually have more than one Ganesha in my house. I have several. So they're all in different poses. And this particular one is really bright pink. And he looks like he's got the drums around his neck. And he's got his four hands up. And it's a very bright and cheerful, but he's got this steely gaze as he looks at me, you know, keep writing, Maura.
So he's there to keep you on track, is he?
Yeah, I mean, Ganesh is the god of writing, the great scribe in Hindu mythology, and also he's the destroyer of obstacles. And I think those are two very good. It's a very good presence to have beside me.
Definitely, yes. Because there is nothing like the writing life to set up obstacles.
Oh, yes. No, there's always cleaning up that needs to be done in the house.
Yes, right through to will I get that email that I've been refreshing my inbox every 2 seconds for.
Oh, yes. Yeah. That's the great waiting game.
Yes, yes, very much so. Now, I'm rather excited because you are the first playwright, as far as I can recall at least, that I've had the pleasure of taking tea with.
Ooh.
And I'm very curious to know, in a medium where I'm assuming, not being a playwright myself, but I'm assuming that the space and the setting are more constrained than when you write prose or comics. I was wondering how that affects your work when you're writing a play.
Yeah, I mean, for me, because I write in a number of different media, the thing I like about playwriting is it really pushes me into an area that I don't normally do a lot of. I should say other media don't encourage, which is to let your characters talk.
Mm.
And so when you're conceiving the idea, you have to think a lot about what's the scenario you're going to put them into. And there's other ways of using visuals in theatre that you don't get in other media. And again, one of the things for anyone who's ever been to theatre, which is so invigorating, is the fact that you are in the presence of people who are going through really intense, usually very intense situations. And you can't escape from them. You can't pause it. You can't mute it. I mean, I guess you could run out of the theatre if it was terrible, or certainly most people would exit at the intermission and never come back. But so it's this incredible art form, which is still living and breathing. And it really stretches me because, especially in comics, you're not encouraged to do a lot of dialogue, you know, in prose as well. There's only so much you can put on the page before you have to go back to the setting and the action. And of course, again, like in film, theatre is very dependent on the actors being of good quality. Mm. If you don't have good actors, no matter how well you've written the script, it's not going to pull it off, you know. So I find it a very challenging, I think of all the media I've worked in, I find it the most that pushes me to really think hard about character. I mean, your characters have to be there.
Yes. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I find it very exciting that you talk about the experience of going to the theatre and how it is fundamentally different in this world where we are bombarded with information, but also where we can just switch it off at any moment. I love the intimacy of the theatre.
Yeah.
Is that something that you bear in mind as you're writing, that the audience is actually physically present? Does that change anything in the stories or the kind of characters that you put into your plays?
Well, I think one of the things after doing a couple of pieces of theatre is you're very conscious of the language. And so, no, I mean, of course, as a writer, you're always conscious of the language, but spoken language is very different to written language. And one thing you very quickly realize is that what looks well on a page may be very difficult for an actor to say. And so one of the things I think a lot about is the flow and the pacing. And so you kind of have this almost organic experience where once you start to concentrate on what's the rhythm and pacing of what the characters are saying, as well as what they're experiencing, then it does sort of change the way you start to write. And the other freedom, as I said, is that you have the freedom to have characters speak at length. And then also to be silent as well, because there's a great power in silence.
Definitely. So when you have a play put on that you've written, how involved have you been?
Well, the I currently have one sort of that's coming up, and it's a staged reading of an extract of one of the plays that I've written. And so already what I've had is a meeting with a couple of dramaturges who were involved with selecting the plays. And because there's six, it's going to be a showcase reading. Mm-hmm. So then they give us feedback on that. The edits are due right now. Yeah. We're going to have a read through, because I was very keen on that. I said, oh, is it possible we can have a read through? So that's going to happen probably at the end of this week or early next week. And then I'll probably do some more edits, because, again, as I said, once you hear them say the words, you start to think, oh, really, that doesn't sound right, you know. And then so then there'll be the actual staged reading will be happening on the 6th of May in Galway here in Ireland, where I'm living, in the Town Hall Theatre. So I'm looking forward to that, but it's a great anxiety as well to sit in an audience with people who can't escape from your work, you know. And it's fun because it's called The Love of Small Appliances, and it's actually about technology and what they call the Internet of Things, which is, you know, connected devices. And several of the characters in this are actually devices.
Oh, wow. So,
yeah, one is a fridge.
Wow.
One is a toast. No, the toaster got cut. He might turn up in another one, but one is a little, you know, one of those little robotic vacuum cleaners that scurries around. It's one of those, and then the other one is the kind of AI of the house. So it's a near future piece as well, because I'm quite a science fiction-y fantasy geeky person. To me, this is interesting. Plus, I think the issue of talking about technology and its impact on our lives is very interesting.
Definitely. Yeah. In fact, that's one of the things that I think is the most attractive about science fiction as a genre, is that intersection between technology and humanity.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That sounds really exciting. So it must be such a thrill when you've written a play to actually see real human beings speaking your words.
Yeah, I mean, it's a real sort of slightly out-of-body experience. And then, you know, the actors change emphasis and do different things with what you've written. The play that I was a part of, it was an anthology horror play in London, which was on in the West End with a bunch of other really good writers. And I went to two of the performances, and they were both different, not hugely, but, you know, subtly different. It's just fascinating to see your character walking around. And I mean, even I think, you know, if you are I've also trained as a screenwriter for film, but that's highly edited. And the screenwriter is mostly uninvolved in the actual process of making it, you know, where in theatre, usually the playwright is highly involved in the process, and their words are what ends up on in the play, usually.
Yeah. That's really amazing. One of the things that I had an experience of when I was very, very first edited, when I was a proper baby writer and I had my first proper editor, was that the editor brought out things in the text just with a few tweaks that I hadn't actually appreciated were there. Is that a similar experience when you have an actor speaking your words? Do you see new things even in your own work?
Yeah, I mean, how an actor can say one line four or five different ways, you know, and that's really quite astonishing. And it's also the power of the actor, I mean, they're essentially, as I say, without them, the words are nothing, you know. It is, and I'm always making notes, and I don't think you ever are very truly ever happy with, you know, what you've done. You know, you start to think, oh, I should have changed that, or, you know, I could have made that a bit longer, or I should have, you know, done something slightly different. But that's okay. That's the nature of the work. Once it's out, it's out.
Yeah. That's really fascinating. Now, you write comics as well, amongst other things.
Yes,
and
I do.
And both comics and plays, as you've already mentioned, have a very strong visual element. I was wondering what the difference is between writing for a comic and writing for a play in terms of the visual elements.
Well, the main thing is budget isn't an issue. This is the great liberation of comics. However, as with anything, these are collaborative art forms. I do like collaborative art forms. And so, you know, a lot of it depends on the skill of the artist and your relationship with them. You know, a good kind of, like I said, with the actor, you know, your story can be the best in the world, but if the artist is, you know, is not as good as you would hope, then it doesn't matter. Yeah. You know, so a good story, you need strong art, essentially. I always say that great art can save a weak story, but poor art will always sink a great story. So, you know, you really need, and I mean, I highly value the contribution that artists bring to my work. And so, yeah, so you don't have the budget issue that you do have in theatre. And also you have to think very much of what can I show? What can I depict without dialogue as much as possible? Weirdly, even though I'm a writer, I think most people only think about dialogue, the bubbles on the page in regarding the writing. But of course, you're conceiving the whole thing and you're thinking about structure and you're thinking about lots of different things, but most people just think about the dialogue as being the bit you write. But dialogue on the page, in my opinion, covers up art, so it has to justify itself. I mean, it's a real trick, and it's you know, makes you think a lot about efficiency and how well you can tell stories with dialogue as efficiently as possible.
And do you feel that that's carried over into your prose writing as well?
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, every time, say, I do a bit of theatre, which I'm doing at the moment, and then when I go back into, say, prose writing, I'll think it teaches me more about dialogue. Dialogue, I think, is very tricky, and moving between people's voices, genuine voices, is something I work hard on, and, you know, sometimes I'm not happy with, but I do the best that I can. But so doing these different art forms, I learn something from each of them, and then I bring it back into the other ones. So they, for me, they feed into each other, and I learn lessons from each one.
I'm in a bit of a strange situation at the moment. I'm preparing to narrate an audiobook in which one of the characters has to have a Texan accent like Matthew McConaughey.
Wow.
So I've been watching loads of Matthew McConaughey interviews, which, you know, that's not too odious a task. But what was quite funny last night was that after watching a good hour and studying the accent, I then went to bed and was reading a science fiction novel, but everything was like in a Matthew McConaughey voice in my head. It was a very strange experience, but it really, really made me appreciate the power of dialect and how what I was reading in the book, which was most definitely not designed to be read in a Texan accent, kept slipping up all the time. You know, there were words which I just couldn't figure out naturally because it was dialect of a completely different kind. Yeah. Is that something that a play gives you an advantage in terms of, you know, the different media you work in? Can you do you play with dialect in your plays?
Well, the one I'm currently, now I actually haven't done that, and I think I do think a lot about naturalistic speaking, you know, and the problem, of course, is that we have lots of ums and ahs in our speech, and you kind of have to eradicate that. And but yeah, I haven't done that so much but it is something I do think about. But mainly what I'm trying to do in theatre is that everybody has a slightly different voice. And I think when you're writing prose, you have to, this is something you think about a lot, because there is no person saying the words, you know, the voice is whatever people generate in their mind. So in some ways, the rhythm and the style, the way people say things has to really evoke the character. So I try to bring that into the stage. And some of that is down to the director and the actor as well may make decisions on that one. You know, they may say something like, hey, can we have a bit more of a, I don't know, a Caribbean accent in this for this character? And then you might have to go off and do a bit of changes, you know, and do research as you were doing. You know, the main thing is you always want your character to sound authentic, however that is.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I find it all fascinating. And it's something that I never appreciated until I started to narrate. Like sometimes I've had to work in audiobooks where it's a period piece set in Georgian England, but it might be an American author who hasn't appreciated that in Georgian England, we don't have blocks. You don't, you know, you don't say to somebody, I'd be delighted to take you in my carriage. It's only two blocks away. And when you try and say it in a, like a plummy accent, it just sounds like blah, blah, blah. There's such a massive, you know, amount of cognitive dissonance. And I think that that's where the transfer of these different aspects of our work can really play out. You work in all of these different media. When you have an idea for a story, how do you handle that? Do you have like a pure conceptual idea and then have to sit down and say, well, shall I make a comic out of this or a play out of this? Or does it always come hand in hand with the medium that you're going to create in?
Well, that's a very good question. And it depends. Yeah, it is the typical answer. One idea I had, which was for a animated film in my mind, right? And I carried this idea, as you often do. It's like you have a little bag of holding in your mind with all these little seeds. You don't know when you're going to yank it out like Johnny Appleseed and throw it onto the fertile ground. But anyway, the seed idea that I had, I thought in my mind, okay, this is going to be an animated movie. And then I was going to see an editor who was a comic book editor, and I thought to myself, well, I better go. It's the classic trilogy. I better go with three ideas. One of them, it came to mind that this idea would actually work in comics, because when I first conceived of it, I wasn't working as much in comics. And of course, then it changes structurally quite a bit. So so that's a project in development, which is in development, the classic term. But that is one case where an idea I conceived of in one form moved into another. I think animation and comics do have a good crossover that can happen. But of course, a lot of, you know, novels get adapted to movies, you know, comics get adapted to TV series. There's lots of fluid movement between art forms. And, you know, I think with the rise of like Netflix and Amazon and all these mini series, you've seen a lot of, you know, novels being adapted into moving novels into mini series seems to be, you know, quite popular at the moment.
Yeah. And I don't know if you feel the same way, but I feel like there's kind of like a golden age of television that we've stumbled into, that so much great stuff out there and so many interesting experiments that are taking place in television, whereas it feels that film is stagnating and
I think with film, yeah, you're always into an issue of high risk with film. It's so expensive to make. And so you have more gatekeepers, and each of them, usually the higher the stake, the higher, the more conservative they become. And so projects, good projects, can get either just destroyed in the development process because people don't want to take risks. And they're often, marketing people will say things as if it's, you know, gospel, when in fact it might be, it might have been true 10 or 15 years ago, but they keep saying it as if it's currently true. And I think they always tend in film to really not give credit to the intelligence of the audience. And I think if you look at television, or I guess we shouldn't even call it television really, but, you know, these miniseries events, they give great credit to the intelligence of the audience. I mean, the adaptation, say, if you want to look at a British show, the of Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, the BBC did, was fantastic.
Loved that.
Yeah. That almost was better, you know, yeah, really good. Yeah. It was really good.
Yeah, I really love that. I really love the use of sound in that as well. Like the sound is like the creaking ship almost. Oh, I loved it so much.
Yeah, no, it was, I was blown away. And I mean, people had talked a lot about the book, but I had not actually read it. And I watched I started watching the show and I was immediately like, I've got to buy this book. So, it's the use of magic and the way it was structured and the characters. It was very compelling drama, and it was perfect adaptation. This is a great example of how effective this mini series can be, especially of a big, you know, universe that was created in that book.
Very much so. And as you said earlier about the impact of the actor, like Mr. Norrell, I adored him in the television series. I really empathized and sympathized with him far more than in the book. I felt more sympathetic in the television adaptation. And I wonder how much of that was the warmth and the talent of the actor, because he's a brilliant actor. I really enjoyed it. Immensely.
Yeah. I think they thought a great deal about the redemptive, like, I hate using that term, the redemptive arc, you know, of the characters. But, you know, that does happen. Your characters are on journeys, either up or down sometimes. But yeah, I think they thought about that. But yeah, what an actor can bring to a role is astonishing. Yeah.
Mm. Now, if you were to rise by a series of extraordinary events to be the total, absolute overlord of the earth, would you prefer to be feared or adored?
Oh no, neither. Oh my God. Both sound equally horrible for various reasons, you know. I guess one of the things is I'm not someone who follows, you know. Mm-hmm. So as a result, I would feel very uncomfortable with the idea of people following, though, you know, we all have Twitter followers, but you know what that means, you know, pretty much, you know.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, sorry, I don't want to duck out of that question. Those kinds of roles are what have brought the ruin of societies.
Yeah.
And they're not something I enjoy.
So you would just try and be benevolent, but encourage people to think for themselves?
Exactly. Yes.
Marvelous.
Yes. That would be much more my style.
Now, whenever I have a friend over for tea, I like to ask on the Twitters if anybody has a question that they would ask if they were able to be here having cheesecake with us. And I had a question sent through by a lovely person called Alexander Mackey, who said, I'm also a comic book writer and have a hard time plotting for a specific page count. Do you have a method for that?
That's a great question. And it's a really essential one for comics, because say, for instance, you have 22 pages, which would be standard for a single issue of a comic.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have an average of about 5 panels per page. So, you know, you're looking at perhaps around a ballpark of 110 panels. And then you've got to think about the beginning, the middle, and the end. And now I'm being that's just really plain, you know. Yeah. It's more complex than that. But if you get very stuck, one of the good things is just to do the math and say, all right, well, I've got to start it. I've got to have the middle bit and I've got to have the end. And then you start to think about what do I need to fit in on each page? And it can be quite tricky. I think a lot about panel layout personally. Different writers have different approaches. And for me, I need to actually have an image in my mind of at least one or two page layouts And then they're, for me, they're like a door I enter into the story. And sometimes that layout might not be the first few pages. It might be some sort of big central and splash page. And I find comics, you know, structure is extremely important in comics. And so you need to think a lot about this and transitioning between scenes. Mm-hmm. And because of the nature of the way pages turn, your scene changes are happening on the turn of the page. So these are other things you need to think about. And often, so often, your scenes comprise of one page or 3 pages or 5 pages. Rather, you know, so you often have very distinct numbers you need to hit. Mm-hmm. And artists really don't like you giving them overcrowded pages. Yeah. You can do it sometimes. But again, if you have a reason for it, that works. And you need to be very cognizant of your artist. If you're lucky and you know what your artist likes, then you can sometimes move to their strengths and give them the kind of work that they like to draw. And that's something I try to do. And the thing is, they're guidelines anyway. The panel layouts, you know, the artist is the expert in visual storytelling and they'll come back to you and offer advice. Mm-hmm. So if you're very open about this and say, hey, this is what I like, if you can come up with something better, cool, and we'll go with that. That's the kind of philosophy I tend to go with. But I do need in my own head to break the story down for me. I need to know how many panels are on a page and how they lead into the various pages. That might change then when the artist comes in, but for me to construct the story, I need to know that. So that's the kind of ways I tend to approach it if I get very stuck. And there might be one big visual in your mind that you want to hit at a certain point in your story as well. And you might build things around that as well. You can do a lot of really cool visual tricks in comics, and so I try to use the medium as best you can.
That sounds really fascinating in terms of a technical discipline that's required for creating in that medium.
Yeah, it can seem like that, though of course. Yeah, but you can't get around the fact it's a physical artifact with limits, page limits, and you do need to work with them. So if you're having a problem with there's too much story for your pages, then you have to think about, can you change the story to get it into? Sometimes I find a great thing Scott McCloud said in his book, Understanding Comics, was the gutters, the white space between the panels is where a lot of the story takes place, right? Mm. So one of the things I try to do is, what can I leave to the audience to put into the white space? And then, so what's the story you're putting in each panel? You know, it's essentially a kind of editing, and again, give your audience a bit of credit. They don't need to see the guy cross the road.
Yeah.
And I think if you notice the way a lot of really good television is being edited, for instance, they do that. They'll say something and cut, and they expect you to catch up, you know. So trusting your audience a bit helps.
Yeah, and I think also if you look at somebody like Spielberg, who sets everything up really early on in a complex scene, so you can acquire information about what is going to happen further on from what he gives you in the opening parts. I don't know if I'm expressing that very well, is it?
Yeah, no, exactly. And the other thing as well is you can use the environment. You know, you can use props and items, and you know, you don't have to tip your hand to everything. And the other thing about structure is, of course, a lot of it depends with comics now, would depend on, are you writing a single issue, are you writing a short story in an anthology, are you writing a 1, 2, 3, you know, or 5-issue miniseries? And they, you know, there's a beginning, a middle, and end in every comic, and then your comic is also a part of a larger arc. So you always have to be cognizant of which comic is it issue 2, and that means it's in the right sort of rising, you know, action. Things are changing. The classic thing is, you know, writing beginning, middle, and end is, you know, you put someone in a tree and you throw things at them, you know, and they have, so you start you have to be also calculating on what issue it is as well.
And I think this really described brilliantly why I'm not a comic writer. I don't think my brain could work that way.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's everybody's got strengths. And I have friends, for instance, who are novel writers who wouldn't write short stories. They don't like to write short stories. And then I've friends who write comics and don't write prose at all, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting because I like writing all lengths of prose, but the idea of dividing it up and having to really nail down, I consider myself a visual writer, but the level of detail at which you have to visualize it for a comic, I think, is a really, really particular skill set, which is something I have a lot of respect for you doing. So something that I always like to ask people I take tea with is, if you could choose a theme tune for your life, what would that be? Because the chickens over there are quite remarkable chickens, and they are very good singers. And I always like to ask this question so that we can ask the chickens to sing it for you. So if you could have a theme tune for your life, which song would you pick?
Well, it's Accentuate the Positive. And it's a great, many people have covered this song because it's an old song. I've heard many versions of it, including one with Bing Crosby and the Andrews Sisters. But essentially, it's all about, I think in life, we often have very difficult situations. And when you're a writer, you often can have many disappointments. I think actually one of the traits of being a writer is being able to deal with rejection and disappointment and changes and adaptations. And what you should learn eventually is that you have to focus on what's working. So when projects don't work out, and believe me, my career is littered with projects that have not worked out. Now, the great thing about them is they're still in my head and they may eventually work out, but there has been a lot of this. But so your only way is forward. So you focus on what you can change and what you can do in your life rather than focusing on what's going wrong. And by the way, of course, we all have bad periods and we, you know, mourn these projects which can't happen. But you just have to keep going. You have to keep going forward and you have to adapt and change and embrace change if you can. So I love this song. It's on my phone and it's on my sort of, you know, upbeat playlist. And, you know, whenever it comes on, it makes me smile and I sing along to it because there are moments of self-pity where you hear the song and you think, wow, I've just got so much going on in my life compared to so many other people. If you sit around focusing on what's not working, you're really going to be very unhappy.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. Hear, hear.
So, thank you.
Little chickens, could you sing Accentuate the Positive for Maura, please? And there they go.
I feel inspired already.
I hope that that hasn't tainted every single time you hear that song now. I hope you won't be haunted by a chicken's rendition.
Yeah, no, I think I might, you know, get a sample of that, play it sometime and remind myself that, you know, even the lowliest fowl can still give a song a good blast.
So what do you have coming out soon that we can look forward to?
Oh, well, I have, I've had a story in what I think is a really terrific anthology called The Grim Future. And this was Grim Fairy Tales reimagined in the future. So and that came out in February in the States and it's edited by Erin Underwood. And my story is called Zell and Gretz, and it's a version of Hansel and Gretel. Because I had written I have an anthology out in a collection in the US called Twisted Fairy Tales. And I didn't do Hansel and Gretel. So I deliberately chose this story for this collection. And I had a lot of fun writing it. It's kind of almost like Hansel and Gretel meets Oliver Twist.
Oh, marvelous.
sort of set in far-flung future. It's like space opera time, you know, because I love that kind of stuff. Yes. And I don't get to write science fiction a lot, and I do love it. So I'm kind of better known for writing horror and dark fantasy. And I have a story coming out in an anthology in Ireland called Uncertainties, which is and 20 Strange Tales, which is edited by Brian Showers. And then, oh God, I've got the play, but you have to be in Galway to go to the, go to the reading. I've got a some very small comic strip in an indie game called Wailing Heights, which is by Outsider Games. I'm actually dipping my toe very, very little bit now into indie games. And I just did a narration, actually, for Podcastle. Territory was the name of the story. It was a really great story. So that's up on Podcastle at the moment. I really like doing radio, and I often do radio for culture, the kind of arena, which is the Irish cultural radio program here. And I come on and talk about comics and science fiction and, you know, that kind of arena itself. So I kind of appear on Irish radio often enough. That's going on. And then a short story of mine called Bone Mother is being adapted into a stop motion animation.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, a short one. And that's being done at the moment in Canada. And it is due out this year. And that is amazing because I love stop motion animation. Yeah. And this was a story that meant a lot to me, and it kind of was sort of not exactly pivotal to my career, but it was the moment where I knew I sort of was onto something.
Wow, you've got so much going on.
This year I'll be writing a chapbook for about a film, so it's nonfiction, and I write essays as well because my training way, way back was actually in academia. So I love like looking at things and breaking it down and thinking what works and what doesn't work and what is it saying mm-hmm. about the text and about the characters and maybe perhaps about the author. Of course, I'm always terrified someone will do that to me.
Yeah, yeah. Occupational hazard.
Yes.
Well, that's fantastic. Let me just check the. Oh, I'm afraid the teapot is empty.
Oops.
We are out
time to
of
go.
Tea. but let me say thank you so much for taking the time to stop by and have tea today because you're so busy.
Oh, it was absolute pleasure to be in such an environment with such great company. Oh. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
I'm so glad that we had a chance to have a proper chat as well, because the last time we saw each other, we were both guests of honor and literally running around all weekend.
Yeah, every time you were on a panel, I was off. And every time I was on a panel, you were off.
Yeah.
I was on a panel with Peter, and I saw more of him in that hour, I think, than I saw, of yourself.
It was a great weekend, though.
Oh, it was fun. It was great fun. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, well, over there, you can see Latimer waiting for you. He's going to point you in the right direction so that you can go and find the lane that the car is in and get back home. And it's getting a little bit dark out there, so do go carefully.
Oh, I will. Thank you.
Take care now. Bye.
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 This way, Mum.
Well, that was nice. I'll just watch here from the bay window, just to make sure she gets there all right. It is getting dark, after all.
I wouldn't worry about that, Mum. It's not as though she's about to become the victim of an attack by demonic cows.
No, that would just be silly. What was that?
Oh, dear.
I can see red lights moving across the field towards the lane that Maura's in.
Those are eyes, Mum.
Latimer, if that's a herd of demonic cows, I'm going to be most upset. I can't believe I've just said that.
What if they were ordinary cows, possessed by demons?
Oh, stop it at once. What are we going to do? They're filling up the lane between Maura and the car.
Preparing for the kill.
Oh, she's pulling out her phone.
Perhaps she's saying her last goodbyes.
Well, there's no need to sound so pleased about it, Latimer.
She'll never get any signal out here. The telecommunication towers are down. Apparently.
No, it looks like she's selecting an app.
Trapped in a lane with demonic cows?
There's an app for that.
Ugh! It's an exorcism app.
Oh, their eyes aren't red anymore. She's using another app now. I wonder what that one is.
She summoned some fairy dogs.
Don't you mean prairie dogs?
No, Mum. Fairy dogs. Look at their collars.
Oh, yes, I see what you mean. Very sparkly. Oh, they're herding the cows out of the way. How splendid.
Yes, very splendid.
Modern technology, eh, Latimer? Marvellous stuff. I wonder if there's an app to deal with mansplaining.
Well, ma'am, the main problem in developing an app like this lies in the very complicated...
Oh, so there is. Whilst Latimer clears away the tea things, I'd just like to say a big... Oh, all this smoke. I can't see a thing. What's going on?
You failed to solve my riddle. I thought even you would have got it by now. 10 years I waited. In the end, I came back in time to check you hadn't died in a freak cow stampede. But no, you're just stupid. The reason you couldn't solve my riddle is very...
Oh, good. It's still working. Time to go, Latimer, before the app's effect wears off.
Very good, Mum.
You've just listened to an episode of Tea and Jeopardy, hosted by Emma Newman and co-written with Peter Newman. Go to www.teaandjeopardy.com to find previous episodes and www.patreon.com/teaandjeopardy to become a Bless Poppet.